I'm Brian Russo, and welcome back to Coastal Connection. Over the past 3 weeks, we've been bringing you a series called Where the Party Never Ends, in which we've been exploring the drinking culture here on the coast. Booze is a multi-million dollar industry that plays a big part in tourism here in our region. Over the past few weeks, we've found it's easier to get a drink in Worcester County than any other place in the state, as there's a liquor license for every 196 people. And here in Worcester, we consume more alcohol than any other county in the state, and by a pretty big margin, too. Worcester also ranks at the top of the list when it comes to binge drinking among underage kids, and alcohol plays a role in a substantial percentage of the calls for service from the Ocean City Police Department. But the fact of the matter is, many of the folks in our communities work in this industry. If you talk to folks who live outside the region, the general perception is that the poultry industry is the biggest job creator here on the shore. But if you look at the top 12 employers in Worcester County, for instance, 9 of them are hospitality businesses, such as hotels, bars, restaurants, and the region's lone casino, Ocean Downs. The poultry industry doesn't even make the list. As we've heard over the course of this series, sometimes the endless summer mentality when it comes to drinking can prove to be problematic for year-round residents. And it isn't just bartenders, servers, or the perceived worker bees of an establishment. Sometimes it's the chef or even the owner who struggles with the excessive nature of the business and this region's lifestyle. Nino Mancari is a lifetime resident of this region. He's a surfer, a father, and a chef who has received high praise from food critics at the New York Times and the Washington Post. He approaches the creation of food like jazz musicians approach an upcoming solo in the jam. Feeling-based improvisation crafted from years of practice, exquisite taste, and an unfettered belief in knowing what will wow people. But Nino Mancari, like so many others in the industry, has struggled secretly and sometimes publicly with addiction, and has felt the roller coaster of success and strife that comes with an industry where 9 out of 10 restaurants fail in their first year. He says growing up here on the coast, booze was just a part of what you saw all around you. And for him, he remembers the exact day it came into his life.
June 12th of 1987, it was the 6th grade graduation, and a buddy of mine and I somehow stumbled across a bottle of Jack Daniels for our 6th grade graduation and ended up getting kicked out of the dance at a friend's house.
What drew you to a bottle of Jack Daniels in the 6th grade? Looking back on it now, like when you found that, was it curiosity? Was it trying to be cool? What do you think drew you to take not only the first sip, but the subsequent ones afterwards?
It probably stemmed from having a crew of older friends wanting to be cool, fit in. It definitely wasn't the first time that I got drunk, but it was the time that stands out as somehow different.
Why does that date stick out so much in your mind now as you look back as a grown man?
I guess looking back at this point, it probably stems from the fact that in that night, nothing really bad happened, but there was the inherent warning by being kicked out. So looking back now with a different perspective, I can see the warnings were there all along. Mm-hmm. So it stands out more of a kind of a harbinger than anything else. Yeah.
How much of a part of your life was drinking, whether it be social or just, you know, is that what people did? Obviously, many young people do that as they're coming up through the latter teenage years into early adulthood. But for you, how much was alcohol part of your life?
Oh, it was nearly a constant. Every weekend party, definitely every weekend drinking throughout middle school, high school. Beach parties in the summer, lifeguard parties, Bartles and James.
You're a big surfer. You've been since you were a boy. Many people in the surf culture, they end up working in bars and restaurants because I think, as you said earlier, when you and I were talking before we hit record, you know, working in a bar and restaurant at night frees up your days and your mornings to surf. Is that what drew you to the industry in the first place?
Definitely some part of that. It was also fun. It was a lot of fun. It felt like being on a pirate ship. You know, I remember working at a bar, 15, 16 years old, after a night of service, you know, pitchers of beer come back and, you know, you're one of the guys. It was just the way it was. It was awesome.
As you grew up through the industry, you know, you went from sort of the low rungs or the entry level positions of the bar and restaurant industry up into, you know, higher ranks. Now you're a very well-respected and well-known chef in this region. Talk about that transition of when it became a serious business to you and not just a really fun occupation as a young person.
Probably by the time I was 19, I started to push myself pretty hard to learn as much as I could about the industry, both front of the house, back of the house. I was working during the day, working at night. I was doing stages in other kitchens, trying to read as many books, cookbooks, trade journals as I could. But that certainly didn't stop the shenanigans. They probably didn't really, really kick in any true sense of the word until I was somewhere near chef, sous chef role.
I know for many people who live here on the coast, since it's such a seasonal economy, many people work, you know, in the summers here, they work those 4 or 5 months, and then they leave town for a while, whether it's to go to another resort like Key West or Colorado, and they go and work there and make money, and it's sort of a, you know, 6 months one place, 6 months the other. Other people, and I'm thinking of many surfers that I know, they work, they make money, and their lifestyle is to go and travel the world after that and catch waves. That was very much what it was like for you. Tell me what it was like when you left here and you did sort of all those, you know, world excursions and adventures. What always brought you back here?
I spent quite a few years working at a restaurant in Bethany called Sedona. We were open basically April through October, and it was a hard work season, but the promise of having 5 months off each and every winter and the financial ability to continue to travel was definitely very appealing. It kept pulling me back each and every year. Plus, having grown up here, all of my best friends are here. My mother is here. You know, there were a lot of good reasons to keep coming back. I love this area. I love this coast. There's a lot of good to be found here.
Did you see when you traveled to other places in the world the way, I guess, the culture and where alcohol played into that culture? Did you see any differences between the way people lived around the world and the way that we live here?
I saw examples of the wild and crazy partying that goes on in some of the resorts here. But for the most part, in metropolitan areas like San Francisco, you know, being in the restaurant industry isn't just a license to party, it's your career. You go to work, you get off work, you go home, you get up, you do your errands, you do your chores, whatever it might be. And that's your job. Your job isn't to pretend to be a rock star around the clock.
When did you know that you wanted to not just be a chef in a restaurant, that you wanted to own a restaurant?
Pretty early and after my cooking began. I wanted to host a party. I wanted to have a place where I could nurture people with food. That was a very big part of my upbringing. Every Sunday as a kid, we would go to my Aunt Rose's house, and she would always greet me out front. And by the time we got in the kitchen, she would have, you know, snacks, meatballs, delicious things. And I remember the place that food held within that comfortable, warm family feeling each weekend. And I wanted to share that with other people.
So eventually, you did own your own place here in this region, and you started to become very successful and very well known. Talk about that part of the ride for you. You know, many people would look at, you know, this, you made it. You know, you've achieved all your goals, you own your own place, you're successful, people are coming, there's bookings and reservations. What did it feel like at that level? Did you feel like everything, all that you had been striving for, you got?
I was waiting for it to all fall into place. The winter that we opened the restaurant, it was pretty much the end of an era of easy lending, easy capital. But I thought with our talent and the team that we had and our location, and with sheer willpower and pride and stubbornness, that we would be able to pull it off. So it was, if you build it, they will come, kind of a scenario.
Do you feel like the stresses of being an owner intensified your sometimes knack or habit of turning to alcohol or other substances to maybe ease that stress behind the curtain, below the surface?
I don't know if it actually comes down to being an owner. From a financial standpoint, it comes down to more of being chef. Any kitchen that I work in, I view it as if it's mine. And I think that's a very much a chef-like quality. I don't know many chefs that don't. It's about the people that you work with, caring about them. So those pressures that mounted when finances were tight, sure, from an ownership standpoint, it, you know, played a role, but it wasn't as if I would stop cooking if I weren't an owner. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. And I think for myself, I probably turned to drinking and substances as a way of finding a scapegoat, to not want to be the reason that there was, that the restaurant struggled, or that we were going to fail. That I wanted it to be, oh well, he's partying, he's drunk, whatever. That would be a better reason that we didn't succeed than any other I could think of.
So basically, if you were going to fail, you'd rather have it be self-sabotage than you not have, you know, perhaps the talent or people appreciate your talent and that being the reason.
I don't know that that was a conscious decision at that point, but in retrospection, I would say that's probably pretty much spot on.
Yeah. People who work in the bar and restaurant industry are more prone to become addicted or dependent on alcohol or other substances. So I guess what I'm trying to do is find out if it's the industry itself or just the fact that there is the availability of all of those things, or if it's both.
I would certainly say that the desire to become part of the party is definitely there. It's, you know, especially if you're a social creature, if you like spending time, you know, in that atmosphere, when you're throwing the party, you always want to join in. Yeah. So that, I mean, the ability to overindulge on a daily basis is obviously right at your fingertips.
Nino, for all the peaks and valleys that this industry has provided in your life, alcohol and in some cases other substances, you know, were sort of in the undercurrent below the surface, ramping up and climbing a similar mountain and taking a similar upward path that your career was taking at that time. When did the two intersect to a point where you needed to make serious changes in your life so that your career and what you had worked so hard to define yourself as a chef or as an owner, so those things could continue?
I would say they began probably in the fall of 2011, 2012, but not in a real way, not in earnest. Some of the searching, self-searching, some of the work was beginning, but I wasn't ready to give things up. I was still in it. But in July of 2014, this year, I lost a good buddy, and I continued to make bad choices. I used that as an excuse to go out, party, live it up off the deep end. Those were choices that I had moved away from to some extent, I allowed that to be a reason to run to substance and alcohol.
Was his death a trigger, you think, looking back on it?
No, because I think it was an excuse. I wasn't happy necessarily what I was with myself, where I was, and I wasn't really willing to do the work that I needed to do or to begin to do, and by no means done.
Yeah.
But to begin that process, I'd gone through a separation away from my kids. There's a million and one things that I could call triggers. However, that's just excuses. I got to the point where I don't even know that I realized I had hit some sort of a bottom, because it was at that point, a relatively high bottom. However, Matt Haley reached out after a relatively bad incident and asked me if I was okay. what I was up to. And, you know, Matt and I have a long history going back to early 2000s, late 90s. And the fact that he reached out when he did, the way he did, really, really spoke to me. A lot of the choices that I had seen him make, looking back over 20-odd years, seemed to have paid off for him. And with his encouragement and his support, I decided to make the changes in my life in order to try to find some of that inner peace. The reality of it being that a month and 10 days later, Matt would pass away.
And let's stop for a moment and give some context to people who may not know who Matt Haley is. But Matt Haley is an immensely talented chef and businessman here on the coast who died on a humanitarian mission in India several months ago. But his story was one of sort of the classic comeback. He had battled addiction and came back and achieved all of this success and overcame all of his demons. And almost every chef I've ever spoken to in coastal Delaware or the Eastern Shore of Maryland that came into contact with Matt Haley spoke about how willing he was to share both the good parts of his mission and the dark places that he had been in the past. Sitting here now, you're 5 months sober, and you are the chef in one of his most well-known restaurants. Talk about his role in the person you are now and the chapter that you are sort of writing for yourself now.
Oh, it's the role that he played is immeasurable. He believed in me when I didn't. He supported me when he had no reason to. And by support, I mean a phone call, a hand, a shoulder. He really helped me to see what was possible by his example.
Do you look at this region, the place where you grew up, and you've essentially spent time your entire life, do you look at it differently now that you're sober?
There's definitely that what now at the end of the night. Now what? You know, and I still like to go out. I still like being around people. I still am a social animal. I love that setting. And, you know, I'll go out after work and go get some pizza or go to a restaurant where other people, or a bar where other people are drinking beer or whatever shots, and I'm asking for a coffee and they look at me like I'm nuts. But I definitely see it differently. I see the role that it plays, and it's pretty immense.
When you were as a boy and you started thinking about being a chef and being in the industry, if you could sort of sit down with yourself at that age and have a conversation and give him one bit of advice, what would you say?
I think the conversation would be to encourage myself to, and it's going to sound cliche, but discipline and moderation, and those were definitely not my strong suits. Almost like Zorba the Greek, you know, extreme. If everything is just is extreme, then it becomes moderate. So if you're working hard, it almost feels like you deserve to blow off steam. And that, I think that's what a lot of people get caught up in.
That was Nino Mancari, the acclaimed chef at Catch 54. To hear earlier parts of this series, click to our website, WAMUcoast.org. I'm Brian Russo, and you're listening to Coastal Connection.